Welcome to the global phenomenon, Surviving the Survivor, where we bring you the best guests in all of true crime. Here's your host, Emmy Award-winning journalist, Joel Waldman.
What's up, STS Nation, and welcome to another episode of Surviving the Survivor, the podcast that promises to bring you the very best guests in all of true crime. And when it comes to Karen Reed, you're not going to get three better ones than this. Now, a juror in the Karen Reed murder trial recently reached out to defense attorney David Unetti to clarify to him that the jury did not think that Karen Reed, the defendant in the previous trial that was declared a mistrial, that she, that the jurors did not think that she knew she hit Boston police officer John O'Keefe, her then boyfriend, and that they found her not guilty of two of three indictments. Now, a new filing in Norfolk Superior Court just this past Monday indicated the jury determined that even if Karen Reed hit John O'Keefe with her now infamous Lexus SUV, that she did not realize that she hit him. In a prior affidavit, David Unetti quoted an unsolicited text message from someone now dubbed Juror B, who's a juror in the trial, that read, and I quote here, "No one thought she hit him on purpose or even thought she hit him on purpose," which is a little redundant, but that was the quote. So best guess here, he is the Brockton bomber, Joseph Krowski, regarded as one of the preeminent trial attorneys in Massachusetts, aggressive, persuasive, but also a very nice guy. Started practicing law more than 20-something years ago, and he's still at it. He's going to have to jump early because he's doing the court TV. So a little before 8, Joe will have to hop off. Then we've got Catherine Loftus, a former Massachusetts ADA, now a criminal defense attorney, and she has Note My Objection, which I guess is TikTok, all the socials. What's your biggest platform, TikTok?
TikTok for sure. I do a little bit of YouTube. I delve into your world. Some Twitter, though I try to stay away from that. TikTok's really it.
There we go. And last but not least, and I just found out he's on vacation doing this. I can't disclose the location, but let's just say it's a very nice place. And it's not far from former President Barack Obama or Alan Dershowitz.
Thanks for giving it away. And you left out Bill Clinton too comes here. So
And Bill Clinton.
How is he going to get me tonight?
If anyone knows where he is, that's where he is. It's an island though, so you can't really get to him anyway. But Peter is a Boston-based criminal defense attorney, a bar leader, an on-air legal expert. He also has books, Super Predators and others. So check out his writing. Catherine Loftus, please explain to me what you were to the audience, what you were just explaining to me, which is today is 8/8, and therefore what, Catherine Loftus? I want everyone to.
They say it's the Lionsgate portal. So if you have anything that you want in your life to happen, today is the best day to manifest it, because 8/8 is apparently the day where the spiritual world and the physical world come together. So if you're, you know, thinking about you want something in your life, you're working towards it, today is the day to put it all into the universe.
I'd like a vacation, but I will take that.
The Zen lawyer?
You're a whole other side to me, Peter.
Yeah, I love it. I actually love it. So let's jump into this right away. There's a court hearing tomorrow. For full disclosure, STS has not been on this story for several weeks since probably the mistrial. We might have done one in between, but they're back in court tomorrow to hear arguments on this motion to dismiss the case. I think at least two of the indictments. Joe Krowski, tell us what's going to transpire tomorrow and what is the defense chances of this happening in Norfolk County?
So the defense has filed a motion based on unsolicited juror contact with at least three, and it seems to be a number that's growing. It might be as many as four or five jurors now. Apparently, from what I gather, there was some confusion, and at least according to these jurors, the jury actually was unanimous, according to them, in counts 1 and 3, the counts that required knowledge on behalf of Karen Reed. Count 1, of course, being the charge of second degree murder and count three being leaving the scene after causing personal injury. To get right to it, what's going to happen? Not much. Unfortunately for Karen Reed's team, I don't think this motion is going to gain much traction. These are experienced lawyers. I think they know that. There might have been confusion, and I hate to say it so bluntly, and it shouldn't be too bad. That's oversimplistic. Having said that, Massachusetts is very technical in what is and isn't considered a verdict. When a jury reaches what they believe is a verdict, they have to record it on the verdict slip. That has to be filed with the clerk of courts, the clerk, the session clerk, who then has to record it on the record in open court. That was not done in this case. It has to be done in front of the judge, the parties, and the jury. There's a lot of decisional authority in this area. There's a case that goes back to 1984, a juvenile case, where the jury actually voted, voted and then wrote not guilty on two separate verdict slips, but never turned them in. And in a decision of the appellate court, they concluded that that was mere negotiation and or discussion. It wasn't a verdict. Now, look, I think the defense team knows this, and I think there's also a PR opportunity, right? They're going to take another chance to tell the whole world this jury doesn't believe Karen Reed intentionally killed John O'Keefe. They all voted not guilty. Then it really becomes a matter of equity. Then D.A. Morrissey, if it's confirmed that they really were 12 to nothing, but some sort of confusion precluded them from appropriately turning in the verdict slip, then it's going to really be up to him to make a decision whether or not to go forward on those two charges.
Hmm. By the way, Lynn Mendoza, what's the latest on possible jury tampering by Trooper Fanning? I'm going to get to that on the back half of the show, but that's a whole other thing. This is the trial that just has so many tentacles and layers that is honestly difficult to keep up with. But again, Karen Reed is due back with her defense team tomorrow morning. Catherine, do you agree with what Joe's saying, that Massachusetts is a highly technical state when it comes to the law? The verdict was not, it was recorded in a certain way, and therefore this motion to dismiss is likely, I guess, according to what Joe was just saying, probably get rejected by the Commonwealth, which of course is going to make the free Karen readers go absolutely nuts. How can you do this? We've allegedly heard from all these different jurors. I think the count is at least five right now, but you know, everyone is sort of saying something differently about how they were approached. The prosecutors themselves were also approached, but just back to that base question of movement in terms of a motion to dismiss, do you agree with Joe that we might just be kind of going up a down escalator tomorrow in court?
Yes, I do agree with Joe. I think that, Joe said, the law is very technical. I think the law is very clear and not in favor of Karen Reed in this case. And I understand the frustration, certainly, because if it's true that there are, in fact, 12 jurors who decided, hey, we would vote not guilty on two charges, it does seem unfair that a defendant wouldn't get the benefit of those votes. The problem is that was never communicated to the judge. Nobody ever inquired about it, either from the defense side or the Commonwealth's perspective. And so there certainly is an argument about how is this fair? If the jury of her peers, which heard all the case, made a decision that would have benefited her at least to some of the charges, why doesn't she get that benefit now? But I think the problem really is that, number one, the law is clear and not in the favor of the defendant. And, you know, it's difficult to ask a court to bring jurors back after the case is over, you know, after they have been able to access, you know, different information, some of the jurors talked about that they knew what the filings were now, things like that. And I think the precedent that would likely set if we were to go in a different direction is not one that the courts would likely want to go in. I do think that it would be it would really be in the interest of fairness if the Commonwealth came in tomorrow and just null pros counts number one and counts number three. I mean, from my perspective, she's been overcharged from the beginning.
Uh-huh.
And clearly, if these allegations are true, which it seems to be based on both the affidavits submitted by the Commonwealth as well as the defense, that no one was even remotely going to consider finding her guilty on these charges. And I think it would carry a little bit of good favor for the Commonwealth if they did what seems to be probably the right thing, which is, you know, drop the count one and three and just try her on the manslaughter, because they seem to be pretty close to, you know, getting a guilty on the manslaughter. So I will be surprised if they do that, but I think that's probably what they should.
Yeah, and that's interesting. Pretty much all of you people, lawyers in the Massachusetts area, other legal minds have all collectively said, look, we think Karen Reed was overcharged. So, you know, maybe if the Commonwealth wants to extend an olive branch, they will dismiss the other two charges. But as Peter and Catherine just said, it's a highly technical state when it comes to the law. So we don't know. Vesper also letting us know that today's International Cat Day. Well, just a very quick side note, on my way to the studio, there's a firehouse next door, and there was a female firefighter, and she was walking a big fat pig. And so I had to get video, and the mama pig's name is Bacon, of course, and she had a baby that's 2 days old that's walking with them. Only in Miami, I guess, only in Florida. So I asked what the 2 day old baby's name is. The 2 day old baby is Bacon Bits. And so I got video, and I just texted it to the COE. So COE, maybe we will show Bacon, and Bacon Bits is literally the size of my hand, if not smaller. Yeah. A 2 day old pig, and Bacon is fat as hell. Fatter, no offense, because she was just pregnant, and she is now breastfeeding. So more information than you need. To you, Peter Elican, I think she already has it in there. Obvious question is, do you agree with the other two? Is this going to go nowhere? But adding on to that, the new trial is supposed to start January 27th. It seems far away, but time flies. It's really not that far away at all. When we get to January 27th, number one, is there going to be a retrial, do you think? And when there is a retrial, if there is, do you agree with Joe and Catherine that we are going to see these other charges still clinging to her? In other words, the murder too, and the leaving the scene.
All right. First of all, I'd like to press it. I'd like to start off by saying that we keep using this phrase unprecedented when it comes to this trial, and we're using it like ad nauseum, and we're beginning to death. And again, this is such an unusual thing. The whole concept, they actually came to a decision, they came to a verdict, and they just didn't happen to mention it to anybody. It just kind of was, you know, normally when I do legal analysis, I usually can back up and mention my own experience. Well, in my situation, this is what happened, et cetera. This is, I've never had a situation like this, certainly in my life, where there was a verdict where they didn't come out and make a definite decision. I generally agree with what Joe and Catherine are saying. I'm probably not quite saying it's an absolute ironclad done deal here either. I mean, there is a certain, I know they're going to be bringing in other case law that says that you shouldn't, how do they phrase that? It shouldn't be, the verdict should not be controlled by the form of action, that the prosecution here is relying on pure formalism, which means they say that they have case law from the U.S. Supreme Court and certain, not case law, but actually constitutional law and case law in Massachusetts that would say that, you know, sort of the will of the jury should be acknowledged. And the fact that they technically didn't dot every I and cross every T doesn't necessarily go against the will of the jury. I mean, having said that, I'm agreeing that this would be a tough uphill thing to do. But the idea that, I mean, if that is true, that the jury really did find not guilty on these two counts, and the fact that therefore, it's kind of ignored because it wasn't done properly the right way. We got to have a complete do-over, start from scratch and ignore that. There is a certain inequity and unfairness to it. However, I guess we're just going to have to follow the law. And when the second part of your question, when you're asking about whether they're going to be going forward on these charges, I actually think that it would really behoove and aid and help the prosecution if they voluntarily drop these two charges. I don't know that I have a feeling they're not going to want to do that voluntarily at all. But, you know, they've got two charges that are very, very weak, and they have one charge, which they should go with their strength. Sometimes when you have a trial and you have some sort of weak arguments, it can kind of drag everything down. Like, well, if that's not true, how about the rest of the case? And so I think it would be helpful, as we've noticed, the murder charge and the leaving the scene of injury or death, that would acknowledge that she intentionally did it and knew that she hit him. And in listening to all the trials, the 70-something witnesses, whatever, I don't even think they brought that up. It really was they never nailed that down at all, that it was intentional. Under the worst case scenario, what people thought, I mean, a number of people thought she was not guilty of the whole thing. And then a number of other people thought, well, then maybe, at best they had evidence that she must have hit him, even if she didn't realize it, and drove away. And the next morning it was sort of like, gee, could I have hit him? Did I hit him? And then it came to like, gee, I hit him. Anyway, I think that the prosecution really never showed any evidence to nail that down, that it was an intentional killing, that she decided to kill him and moved ahead and did that. We didn't even hear evidence on that. So I don't know why the prosecution wouldn't want to absolutely get rid of those two charges and go with their much, much stronger charge. When you ask, is this trial going to happen in January? Well, Judge Cannone was very frank and honest when she said, whichever way I rule on this, I know which the other side's going to go to the appeals courts. And so there is going to be some, and that's one of the reasons she put it off till January, because she knew that once it goes to the appeals courts, that can take some time. And so that's going to have to go through that exercise. So the fact that they set the January date, that's not hard and fast, where people, continue cases all the time. I know there's no real desire. I mean, this case has gone on long enough. It was a couple of years even before we had the trial, and after the 9-week trial, now we have to have a do-over during the next year. It is to everybody's regret that this is happening. So I actually do not, from what I can make of the prosecution, I think they're zealous in this prosecution as can be on all three counts. And I'm only guessing and speculating, but I don't think they're going to want to voluntarily back down on any of the charges.
There's definitely some Karen Reed fatigue. Joe, hang on one second. Look at this. Catherine from Mabel, UK. 8888 was the spiritual day. She spent it on the Isle of Avalon, Glastonbury, where the Holy Grail is meant to be. Catherine, you thought you were serious. You are no Mabel, UK. Joe Krowski, jump right in.
Sure. No, if it's confirmed, right now we're still hearing just from anywhere between 3 to 4 to 5 jurors. And one of the things the attorneys for the defendant did was, because you got to be really careful when you reach out and have juror contact, and you've got to really be careful to refrain from asking them about the content of their deliberation. So it looks like in one of the filings, they're asking for permission because they want to authenticate the identities of the people that have contacted them. So then if they're able to do that, and if they are able to take the next step and confirm that 12 people voted not guilty, I think, District Attorney Morrissey is also a former he's a politician. He's a smart guy. I think he would take a really hard look at that murder charge, because I think they know, they're experienced attorneys in his office. They knew from the start that charge, or at least I believe they knew, was a reach and was going to be difficult. Now they've got some validation and corroboration to that. As far as the appeal, look, the appeals court, the Supreme Judicial Court and appeals court, they have televisions, they have social media. They're not going to interfere with this trial schedule. First of all, I think it's so black and white that they would deny it summarily when they filed the 211-3 petition. Even if they did accept it, they'd put it on an expedited track to get the 211-3 heard on that issue, to try to do what they can to keep that court that
talk to us in English. So what is the 211-3 is what exactly? Is that just the appeal?
So if there's an issue that's not post-conviction, it's an issue while the trial's going or while the case is still live, meaning there hasn't been a verdict, you have an opportunity to file what's called a 211-3. It's a petition. You file an appeal to essentially deal with an evidentiary issue, an issue that's still going, and a single justice will look at it. And they've got a couple of options: kick it down to the appeals court, send it to the full bench, or rule on it themselves and then send it to the full bench. But again, I think typically what they do to defendants is deny it and say, you've got a remedy. If you lose, come back and see us after trial, and we can revisit that issue.
By the way, I want to point something out. You see Tim Jansen, John Singer, those criminal defense attorneys with mahogany and glass bars. Look at Joe Krasky's office. That's a blue-collar man's office right there. Hard worker. That's why we call him the Brockton Bomber. Nothing crazy, fancy. Reminds me a little bit of my dad's office. But you know what? Work gets done in that office. No, yeah, work gets done in there. Courtney H., I'd much rather have a man with an office that looks like that. No offense, Tim Jansen, I love you, than all the mahogany. I know this guy's working. Working. Courtney H., to Catherine, doesn't the judge have a responsibility to ask the jurors about their intentions and if they were confused? What is the deal with that? Does she have to speak to them?
She doesn't. She doesn't have any responsibility. I mean, I would use probably maybe the word requirement in place of responsibility. And, you know, under the rules, it's very clear that the way it was written was that the judge is able to, it's within her discretion. She could inquire. She may inquire. You know, she may ask the jury to return some verdicts before they continue deliberations, but there's no requirement that she must. There's no must in the rule. There's no shall in the rule. And I think that's the, can sometimes be the difficulty in really understanding that, as my, you know, co-panelists know, the law is very technical, right? And so when we want a judge to do something and we want to require a judge to do something, the rule will very clearly and explicitly state that the judge must do this, or the court must do this, or a party must do this. When a rule uses the word may, it essentially puts the discretion into the hands of the judge, which then means in the moment, based on all the information that she has, she gets to make the decision. And so the question is, the information that she had at the time was that we had three notes, very well-written, thorough notes from the foreperson that outlined specifically, we're having a difficult time, we're at an impasse, we're unable to reach decisions. Nowhere in the notes was any indication, I think, to any observer that they were decided on some and not on the others. Had they asked that, do I think she would have inquired? Yes. But because she didn't, it's really difficult to then come on the back end and say, well, shoulda, woulda, coulda. And I don't think anybody, you know, myself watching it, the Commonwealth at the time, the defense at the time, nobody picked up on the fact that there could possibly be some verdicts on some charges and not on the others. And so the answer is no, there's no requirement for her to ask. And I don't think there was any information which should have prompted her to in that moment. Unfortunately, because if that's the case, then, you know, she should have gotten the benefit of that verdict being returned. But we can't, you know, we can't go backwards in time.
I was going to say, yeah, you can't go back in time. From Lee T here to Peter. Can the jurors' names be permanently sealed in this case to protect them? I think the judge has at least indefinitely impounded their names. We remember the day of the mistrial being declared. Jurors said they could hear the protesters outside, and that raised a lot of concerns. You know, was there juror intimidation from the protesters and the crowds? But what about this issue, Peter? We're going to try to sort this out in a minute with I'm going to ask Joe a couple of questions about the number of jurors and all that. But you know, it's obvious. I don't have to tell everybody this. It's a very contentious trial, and they want to protect the rights of these jurors. So you think we'll ever find out their names?
That's absolutely the judge's discretion. And my sense would be, no, you're not going to ever find the, out their names. That the jurors, and I mean, this is obviously, I keep using this word unprecedented, but this isn't how it typically goes. Normally what we see, the verdict comes in and then they release the names and then the reporters call them up or show up at their houses. And then some of them are interviewed on TV and some are interviewed just, you know, not on air or with their names, you know, and, that's how it goes more often than not. But in this case, I guess there really is a genuine fear that there's such a passion out there. And, you know, there's accusations that, you know, that during the course of this case, that a lot of the witnesses were harassed with people showing up with, you know, bullhorns outside their houses or the kids' sports games, et cetera. And so I could see why the average juror, if a juror did, you know, say that they found her guilty, I could see them being afraid about being ostracized in their community. And we want jurors to be able to be free to, you know, express themselves and not be in fear like, gee, if I go, you vote one way or the other, that I'd be putting myself or my family in danger. So I think that they have that right to have it sealed. There's nothing that can force a judge to release her names, and I'm just not so sure she would, because it would really be a chilling effect on future juries. That and yet, having said that, this is pretty rare, because in almost every case, the majority of cases, that the names do get disclosed right after the trial.
Yeah, that's typical, but not here. Joe Krowski, just take us to tomorrow again. Giovanni's Pikachu, who's the Commonwealth even going to call? How does tomorrow work? I mean, what should we expect? Is it a little tiny mini trial? Will we get a ruling from Judge Cannone tomorrow? What should we expect?
I don't know if that question is pointed towards a retrial or tomorrow's hearing. Tomorrow's hearing is just a hearing. It's not an evidentiary hearing. There are not going to be any witnesses that would be called. The judge certainly could bifurcate, and if she thinks there's a threshold showing that's made that warrants her taking evidence, she certainly has the discretion to bring one or more jurors in. But typically, a judge isn't going to do that unless they hear evidence of malfeasance or misconduct or extraneous influences being brought into deliberations. And that's not what you have here. What you have here is apparently some post-trial confusion, which, again, to Catherine's point, is kind of interesting. The foreperson writes like he's Tolstoy or Hemingway. He writes these great letters, and then for some reason, they can't figure out the verdict slips. Wouldn't it be ironic if Alan Jackson comes out from California to Massachusetts, criticizes the verdict slips that we've used for 50 years, gets the judge to change them, and then the jurors end up confused about the verdict slips that he had changed.
I never thought of it that way. By the way, I haven't heard much about Alan Jackson. It doesn't sound like he's going to be around tomorrow, and it's unclear whether he will be here for trial number duh, but we will see. Rosemary Romero, this is going to get some people upset, but it's part of the Karen Reed trial. Why doesn't Karen Reed, Catherine, just plead guilty to manslaughter now that she knows that the jurors would have likely given her manslaughter? And again, keep in mind that this is all sort of speculation, innuendo, and things that people are hearing and or reporting. I mean, it is fact that the jurors have reached out to the Commonwealth and reached out to defense attorneys, but I guess no one for 1,000% sure knows exactly what they were saying. But what about this, Catherine? I mean, I don't see her ever pleading to a manslaughter charge. Do you?
I don't. I think in a normal world, this is likely something that at least would be discussed with her attorney. You know, the fact that, okay, we went through this whole trial, we presented an entire alternate theory, and close to a majority of the jury didn't buy the theory and was going to vote guilty. Like, we have to talk about what can we discuss? What are some options on the table with the DA? I think in a normal circumstance, that's what would be happening behind the scenes. In this, it's very different. Like Peter said, it's unprecedented. And because the public and the PR kind of campaign plays such a role in this, I don't think there's ever a world where her team would now go backwards and have her stand in open court and admit to doing this. Because, I mean, And I think it actually might open them up to liability and maybe a civil fence or different things. The fact that, you know, this is really a story that has been told from one perspective by the defense. And that's a very specific story from, you know, aside from the Commonwealth. And so I don't think that I don't think she could take. I don't think they can take the hit to have her plead guilty. I mean, they say she's not guilty. And so there's the, you know, always the, you know, if she's not guilty, you don't want to plead to something that she didn't do. So I think there's a lot of things that go into it. But from my perspective, probably the number one reason why we'll never see her plead guilty to anything is because that would essentially mean admitting that the entire, you know, theory was false.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, by the way, it sounds like the jurors did not buy that at all. I was just reading reports, Peter, that, you know, Alan Jackson was maybe upset with David Yannetti because he was the one pushing this cover up slash conspiracy, whatever you want to call it. But clearly, if all these reports are true, the jurors did not necessarily buy that aspect of the defense. Brianna wants to know, Peter, why are they so adamant on charging Karen Reed? And I'm going to couple it, if you want to start there, with this comment from Jimmy McNutty, who he, by the way, he says, "I'm not a lawyer. I heard more damning character evidence can come in with a murder indictment than a manslaughter indictment. Was I misinformed? Advantage to bolster manslaughter." He's wondering if that's why the murder charge was there. Is there any credence to that, that you can admit, Joe?
Yeah, if I could just jump in, that's a really interesting question that I had not thought of, because to show intent, the Commonwealth was allowed to admit into evidence, which is fairly legion in Massachusetts, evidence of a hostile relationship between Karen Reed and John O'Keefe. So a lot of that other evidence, the Aruba trip where she said, you know, fuck you to that woman she just met, a lot of the prior history, a lot of the texts with Higgins, arguably don't come in and don't see the light of day if it's just manslaughter. Really interesting question.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I guess we're going to find out if that's, you know, going to be allowed in terms of a murder two charge again come January. But Peter, Brianna's question was, why so adamant? I mean, is it just a matter of the law, or is there kind of a personal vendetta here with the Commonwealth against Karen Reed in this case?
Well, first of all, I'd like to back up on that other thing about why doesn't she just plead to manslaughter. The jury did not find her guilty of manslaughter. It was a hung jury. And so there's still a question. Will we ever have 12 jurors find her guilty? Well, they've got to be, you know, proven beyond a reasonable doubt. There's a great argument that not only it's not as if, gee, the defense sees the handwriting on the wall. If the rumors we hear are true, that it was sort of like 8-4, that's not enough to convict. And who's to say in another trial that there's going to be that much stronger a case, or a jury's going to find her guilty? I think the fact that normally in so many cases you get a hung jury, and that's considered almost a victory for the defense a lot of times. Hey, they weren't able to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. You had enough of the jurors doubting it. And I would look at it that way too, that is not the handwriting on the wall. It's a done deal. Have a trial. Obviously they're going to find her guilty of manslaughter. They most certainly did not in this last trial. And there's not any great reason to believe that the next jury is going to be able to be unanimous on that also. As far as why the prosecution is pushing this case, I guess there's two theories. What they would say to you, obviously, is, well, they, you know, this is our job. We're here to enforce justice, and we find there's enough evidence in our minds that she was guilty of this. So why would we just walk away and let somebody off the hook if that's what we believed? Of course, you've got this whole sort of theory of that sort of sides with the defense, that it's part of a group of friends were covering up because they actually were the ones that killed them. So you'll hear that side of the argument. So I guess those are the two sides, that it's probably they had to pin it on her. Otherwise, it's going to fall somebody and somebody what they did inside that house. And I assume the prosecution is, which is really dedicated to this case, I see. genuinely dedicated. And I think their argument would simply be, this is our job. This is what we do for a living, enforce justice. And this is our view of it, that we think there's enough here to bring the case. And why would we just walk away and let somebody go scot-free if we genuinely think that there is evidence to show that they were guilty?
Yeah, by the way, Linda Mitchell here, she's got the spelling a little wrong, but Proctor, Buchanan, Tully are all under investigation. Who would they call? Trooper Paul is the accident reconstructionist that everyone's kind of poking fun at. So that's another point to make. But Joe Krowski, before you have to jump off the court TV, you got a little bit of time left with us. But so according to the defense, now this is the latest, it's kind of hard to keep up, that they're saying basically that five jurors have come forward, five jurors. Commonwealth responded to that in a filing saying basically not so fast, and called this unsubstantiated and sensational. We talked about this too. Judge Cannone has indefinitely impounded the jury list, and the defense has filed the third memo now in support of a motion to dismiss. But back to this whole point of five jurors coming forward and the Commonwealth saying unsubstantiated and sensational. I mean, Joe, what's really going on here? Like, who do you believe? Obviously, if you're of the Free Karen Reed camp, you're going to say, yeah, five jurors came forward. But if you believe in Karen Reed's guilt, you're going to say, oh, I don't know. Did they really come forward? What are they really thinking? How do you break this down in reality? How do you figure it all out?
Well, if you looked at, I think it was one of the more recent filings from the Commonwealth, it seemed like they did acknowledge finally having communication from one juror. And this goes back to your question to Peter about why do you try the case and could there ever be a plea? I don't think there can. I agree with Catherine. I think both sides have kind of backed themselves into a corner. But you've got to remember, if you now believe what's being filed, 8-4 or 9-3, that's 75% of those jurors, even with all of the Proctor information and all of the other problems, 75% of the jurors believe that the Commonwealth proved the case beyond a reasonable doubt, the manslaughter charge. That's got to be a little bit unnerving if you're in the Karen Reed camp, because statistically speaking, retrials are not very good for defendants, because the shock and awe and the wow factor and the element of surprise is somewhat blunted. But again, if you look at what everyone's filing, there's a lot of public relations going back and forth. That's why I think Judge Cannone is going to want to nip this in the bud. And to Catherine's point, the precedential value, you're not going to want to start relitigating a verdict, something that never was a verdict. What you have not heard alleged from the defendant, again, is that there was any misconduct, that someone, one of the jurors, brought in information that shouldn't have been in there, and that was part of the deliberations, that someone from law enforcement or the district attorney's office had impermissible contact. So even for the sake of argument, if you believe that they, you know, had this discussion, negotiation, and couldn't come to believe she was not guilty, there's just not enough there. So I think Judge Cannone isn't going to make a decision from the bench, but I think shortly thereafter, within less than a week, she'll have written findings denying the motion. And I'm not taking either side. I'm just saying objectively, as a matter of law, I think that's where she is. I don't think she has discretion to go any other way.
So you think we find out sometime mid to end of next week what her ruling is on this?
Right, because she'll foresee an appeal, that they're going to appeal this, and she'll want to get that moving. She doesn't want to dump this albatross on any judge's lap. She's taken a lot of hits in the public, and I think she's been pretty courageous in keeping this case and not passing it off to someone else. There's been a lot of untoward and unpleasant things and unfair and untrue things said about her. You can ask any defense attorney that practices in Norfolk County. She's one of the draws that you want when you have a case. And I don't think anyone that really knows what they're doing can say she didn't let the defense pry their case. She gave them a tremendous amount of leeway.
That was just my mom FaceTiming me in the middle of a show for some reason. I had to hang up on her, even though it was her 85th birthday yesterday.
Happy birthday.
Yeah. We're going to play a little happy birthday song. We were in Atlanta and they got her a cake. We had this amazing book signing and the whole thing. We'll show you that and bacon and bacon bits at the end of the show. What a tease. You got to stick around for that. Catherine Loftus, I just had a comment up there that, you know, they are reporting that the jurors were 9-3 in favor of guilt in on the manslaughter charge. That's a pretty substantial, you know, margin in favor of the Commonwealth. So, I mean, what if you are the Commonwealth, what do you do with that? I mean, that's your bread and butter. Are you going to just go to Judge Cannoni tomorrow and say, look, nine of the jurors, if this is true, said, hey, she's guilty of this. She must be retried, and therefore she must be retried on all the charges.
I mean, from the Commonwealth perspective, they're going to say there was no verdict returned. There, as Joe said, there was no allegation of misconduct. There's no basis in the law for us to either inquire of these jurors to bring them back, that the motion to dismiss should be denied. You know, from, I think probably the smartest thing would be to do is, because obviously there is, you know, you want to believe that the Commonwealth feels that they have a good faith basis charging a defendant with anything, right? So from their perspective, they believe that they have a good faith basis to go forward on the second degree murder charge. Despite that, what we now know, if all this information is correct, is that just even though they think that they have something on the second degree, no one is agreeing with them, right? And so the best thing for their case moving forward, if they want to get a guilty on anything, because I think it's very unlikely that they get a guilty on a second degree, even the second time around, why waste all the time of going through trying to prove intent, going through, you know, what their relationship was, all these things, when really, when you come down to the manslaughter, it's much easier to prove than a second degree murder. And if you already, despite having months and months of this alternate theory presented to you, the jury still says, at least, you know, 8-9 jurors out of 12 said, yeah, we know there's this whole other theory. We don't believe it. Most of us think they proved it beyond a reasonable doubt, but a couple of us didn't. If I was the Commonwealth, I would be saying, let's throw everything we have at the manslaughter and focus on that. Because really, I think what it ended up being was a little bit of a distraction. The second degree was really a distraction from what most people, if you think she's guilty, think is the reality of the case, is that there was alcohol involved and that she hit him. That's really what the strength of the Commonwealth's case is. To really spend all this time and in a way waste time and resources to retry the second degree when we all know the likely outcome again seems to be, it does not seem to be the right thing to me. And I think they'd probably have a much better chance of convicting her the second time around if they really just focused on the manslaughter charge. But I think they're pretty entrenched, and that's the problem, that no side wants to back down because they see it as kind of a loss. And, you know, that's unfortunate.
Yeah, it sounds though like it's going to be a mess for the Commonwealth in large part due to the disaster that's going on with the investigators on that case and the mess that they're all mired in. Peter, I promise I'm coming to you, but Joe's got to run in a minute. So let's, Linda here says the constitutional lawyer is going to be doing the talking tomorrow. So Karen Reed has a new attorney who's supposed to be one of the best in Massachusetts, yes. A guy named Martin Weinberg. Joe, what do we know about Martin Weinberg?
Well, you know, he's more Peter's generation, so maybe Peter can talk to
Peter,
him.
Peter, who's Martin Weinberg?
Yeah, we geriatrics should weigh in on the this.
No, he's not necessarily just a constitutional lawyer. He is, you know, he is revered around here. And, you know, back in the day when he was one of the mob attorneys, when the mob still existed here in Massachusetts. So he has a terrific reputation. I don't know if he still tries a lot of cases, but I know he still has an active practice. And I think he's out in front of this motion to dismiss argument. They want him to be the face of that issue. I don't know if he's signing on for all purposes, including the case in chief that's coming in January. I can't believe Alan Jackson even given someone an inch of space to try the case. But yeah, he certainly has a terrific reputation, but Peter probably knows him. Him and I don't know each other.
Peter and Joe, I want you to stick around as long as possible. But whenever you have to go, just jump on off.
Sure.
But, go. Yeah, Peter, what about this guy, Martin Weinberg, that you can add?
Marty Weinberg is an absolute giant of the criminal defense bar, not just in Massachusetts, but certainly he's had some legendary cases. You know, we talk about organized crime in, you know, in New York City and, you know, I believe in Florida and around the country. He is an absolute giant. And just and also just on the not just a show, the showboat, but a really intellectually on the intellectual area of the law. He really just is just razor sharp on his knowledge of the law and the way he argues it. And he's one of the I would argue he's one of the greatest lawyers in the United States today. And
Peter, hold on. Let me stop you right there. So here's my question. All you guys are super smart. You know, you have to be smart to just become an attorney. You've kind of outlined it a little bit, but what really does separate him from the pack? What makes him one of the best lawyers in America?
It's Carm here. You know, the one constantly being interrupted by my son on STS. I still love him, and I think you love his book, Surviving the Survivor. While it includes my Holocaust story, it's also about, as I always say, surviving in a rough world and staying positive even during the worst of times. Oh, and it's very funny. Well, maybe not very, but just funny, except for my cursing, which I'm embarrassed about. But I promise you, you will laugh, you will cry, and you'll feel normal compared to us. Order your copy, Surviving the Survivor, on Amazon right now.
I think it's just his, he was a legend when I first became a lawyer. He was famous for, he had famous case after famous case, and he was doing, getting victories on very, very, very difficult cases. And he was in such demand that people from around the United States were calling him in. And as I said, he is just, I know we throw this around. We keep calling other, we lawyers keep calling each other brilliant and all that, but he really is absolutely brilliant. And he really does, he really does stand above, kind of his generation. It is kind of a bit of an older generation at this point, but he really stands head and shoulders above so many others. People really talk about him with great reverence and respect.
Joe Krowski, since you're still here, let me ask you about double jeopardy. I mean, that's a legal phrase we hear all the time, but it's an argument that the defense is saying, and I think in one of their motions, the quote is, the double jeopardy protections of the federal and state constitutions require that those two counts, the first and the third, the most severe and the lesser charge, not be retried. What does it mean in English? What does this mean?
What it means in English is that you cannot be placed in jeopardy for the same crime twice, unless the problem is once you seat a jury, certainly you're in jeopardy. You're at the mercy of that jury. However, an exception to that is if there's a manifest necessity, the judge has the discretion to dismiss that jury and declare a mistrial. And that's what happened here. So again, we're kind of getting into the technical weeds. But jeopardy does not attach on a declared mistrial unless it was a mistrial occasioned by prosecutorial misconduct, meaning that in the middle of the trial, a government witness blurted out something they weren't supposed to do, or they found out, like the Alec Baldwin case, the prosecutor had withheld evidence. Under those circumstances, there is an argument, Commonwealth, you can't bring me to trial again. You had me at trial, and based on your malfeasance and misconduct, it was a declared mistrial. A mistrial, because it's a hung jury, jeopardy does not attach. And again, I was having a little fun with Marty Weinberg, and I do hear great things about him. But to answer your question, I don't know if he's going to distinguish himself from any other really seasoned, experienced, intelligent attorney, especially when it comes to this motion. He's not going to be able to make up law. The law is what it is, and it's really not forgiving in this area. I think what he does is he brings a certain amount of gravitas, and that's part of the machinery, the PR machinery that the defense is striving for in this case.
Mm. Joe, let me ask you a question that's neither here nor there, but I'm curious about. So, you know, in TV news, they say you fake it till you make it. How long did it take you as a criminal defense attorney from the time you began practicing till you really felt comfortable? I mean, you throw out, all you guys throw out, you know, case law, different aspects of the law. How long did it take you before you really felt like you had come into your own as an attorney?
Well, my father's been a lawyer for 40 years too, tried homicides for the better part of 40 years. So I grew up going to court and watching trials. So I think that certainly gave me a little bit of a head start. But when I was a prosecutor for about 18 months, but I never wanted to put anyone in jail. So I switched to the defense side. And what I did that first year, I just tried as many cases as I could. I think Brockton Superior Court is right outside of that wall. I tried 13 trials in 1 year, just kept trying them and trying them and trying them. And you can't be afraid to make a mistake, but it's why they call it a practice. We're always getting better, always learning new things. And we all, you know, we still make mistakes, and, you know, mistakes can be costly in this business. So, but, you know, it takes a long time, but we're always perfecting the craft.
Who was a better lawyer, you, your dad, and who had a nicer office?
He's definitely got a nicer office. I'm just too busy. I've got the new carpets, everything on order. I just don't want to vacate my office for a week for them to come and paint and do everything they need to do.
There you go. It's always evolving.
I've got to sign off now.
Okay.
Thanks for having me, Catherine. It was terrific being on with you,
nice
Peter.
To see you.
Terrific being on with you. I'll see you all soon.
The Brockton Bomber. The lore continues. See you later, Joe. Thank you. Love the Brockton accent there. So, Peter Ellicamp, back to you on this one. So the latest thing here really is this juror reaches out to Yannetti, the defense attorney, and again, clarifies to him that the jury did not think that Karen Reed knew she hit her Boston police officer boyfriend. What do we do with that? I mean, legally, I guess, what do you do with that? Whether she knew she did it or didn't. And you were just saying, like, the, you know, there was no real evidence that was brought by the Commonwealth to prove that it was even done intentionally that we can recall, right?
Right. It's unusual that you really bring a charge, and at no point do you really have evidence to back it up. And there really just didn't seem to be any evidence. Everybody who sort of, any lawyer or prosecutor I talked to anywhere just said, well, that murder charge was just overcharging. It was just really wrong. And so everybody was kind of in lockstep on that and in agreement with that. I think as far as, when Yannetti hears things like that, I guess hearing that was interesting to see the way the count went down. If there were eight or nine people thought it was guilty and it was three or four thought it was not guilty, you can spin that either way. You can say, well, look, obviously we're never going to get a jury that is going to agree to guilt and be unanimous on that decision. And there's just way too much reasonable doubt. And I guess you could spin it the other way, say, well, more people believe the prosecution's charge of manslaughter than the defense. So I'm not quite sure what you can do with that other than just retry the case. I don't think it's a done deal, certainly for either side. When Yannetti was getting those phone calls, and I guess or text or whatever they were, those communications, and Simon, now we hear that they're not the only ones. Prosecution also got that. It would really be great. And I don't know if there's any legal way to force. I don't believe there's any legal way to force, but it would be nice if we could really nail this down. If we could determine, did they or did they not? And at least know that at that point. And then and if we find out that they were, unanimous and they really did reach a verdict on two of the counts, then maybe they can enforce it. but it certainly would be helpful all around to everybody if we really got to the bottom of this. Because when the prosecution says, well, right now, this is only hearsay or speculation about the juries that, you know, saying that we reached a verdict on these two counts, they're absolutely right. And there's no way we're going to know unless somehow that gets nailed down. If the judge really wanted to find some way to poll the jury, even to not do it in public where they had to reveal themselves, you can either bring them in for a non-public hearing, or you can somehow reach out officially and legally, contact them and ask them the question. And I'm not sure they're going to do that, but that would be the way. I think we'd all be really, really curious, and I think it would help both sides if we could really nail that down. Because right now, it's true, we are just hearing. We're hearing enough of these, but that they were absolutely unanimous and reached a verdict on these two counts. That would be helpful, even if it can't be enforced.
There's a question going around, which is how much is manslaughter in terms of prison time? And then Dizzy answered, Catherine, 5 to 20 years in mass. Does that sound accurate? I mean, if it's a big if the case is retried and if she's convicted on the manslaughter charge, how much time do you think realistically Karen Reed would get?
So what she's charged with, which is manslaughter while operating under the influence, that's a 5-year minimum mandatory. And so that means if she was convicted of that charge, she would have to serve a minimum of 5 years in state prison. It can go upwards from there. But that would, when we talk about minimum mandatories, that means that the judge does not have the discretion to go less than what the statute says. So if she was convicted of count two as charged, which is manslaughter while OUI, she would have to serve at least 5 years in state prison.
And then, Catherine, what about this? I mean, Jerry Michael wants to know, since Michael Proctor's been fired, I don't know if he's actually been fired yet, but he's just been reassigned, and he's reassigned, I think, without pay at this point. Does he still get called to testify? What do they do about this?
So that's a really interesting question. He's not fired as of now. He is suspended without pay. And I don't believe that we have the results of any, I believe they already had the disciplinary hearing, but we have not heard anything specific about that. The interesting thing is most of what Trooper Proctor testified to, he actually had somebody else with him with almost everything. He had another trooper there. Most of the time it was Sergeant Yuri Buchanek. So in theory, Sergeant Buchanek, you know, if there's anything that Trooper Proctor did just on his own that nobody else can testify to, they would have to call him. If the Commonwealth thinks that anything they need can be introduced through the testimony from another witness, they will do that. It's going to be interesting to see. And I think this is why it's all about figuring out what is the strategy the next time around, right? Because if the Commonwealth doesn't call Proctor, then the defense can certainly call him, but then he is subject to direct examination, not cross-examination. And so if he's answering questions, it's a little bit more difficult to get what you want from a witness if they're adverse to you and you have them on direct. So that's going to be a tactical decision by the DA's office, whether they call him or not. If at that time we have a decision about whether he is in fact terminated, whether he will remain employed, that once it's finality to that investigation, they'll be able to question him on it as to his bias or anything like that. So it'll be interesting to see. I don't know whether they'll call him. I wouldn't be surprised if they don't, but they might. But the defense might call him anyway. So it'll be interesting to see.
By the way, very quick programming note. Yours truly is flying to see my family, the COE's family, tomorrow. So no Phil and Scott. And then I'm flying back next Friday. I might be able to do a Phil and Scott next week. But all next week, we've got episodes of Surviving My Biggest Case. And they're pretty cool. Won't be live shows next week. So please check them out. And as the scroll says there, I will be at the Grove in LA on Thursday. Please come say hello if you're in the area. Peter Ellicant, Jersey Girl, says not guilty if she didn't know. That's not completely true, though, right? I mean, that's what does the law say when it pertains to manslaughter? I mean,
that would be if the accusation against her is that she was intoxicated, and if you're driving either reckless, if you hit somebody, it usually means that you were driving that you were driving not responsibly. That was negligent operation, and if you and if you do that, you can still be charged with manslaughter. If it's reckless driving and somebody gets killed and you don't even realize it, or if you're driving drunk and somebody gets killed. And again, it's not an intent. You would never mean to do that. And you can still be charged, and not with murder. I mean, murder would be more of an intent, but you can still be charged with the lesser crime of manslaughter, which would have sort of dramatically lesser, punishments if you're found guilty. But yes, most certainly, if you don't know that you did it, but you were driving recklessly or driving while intoxicated, and somebody gets killed because of your bad behavior, certainly you can be charged and prosecuted. Even if you would never hurt a soul intentionally and you didn't mean it and you had no idea you even did it, you're still under the law responsible.
Mm. But I love this comment from Gigi. Joel, I received my sweatshirt and T-shirt for SCS Nation this week. The tee is very soft, which I love. I can't wait for the rain to stop in PA so I can walk my dog and give you free advertising. Please tag us on Surviving the Survivor. I like to slap STS stickers on random places in foreign countries. I'm all about the free advertising. So there you go. Catherine, back to you on... this person who said, even if Karen hit John O'Keefe, she didn't know it. Well, Juror B is a person who's been quoted here. I've got an actual quote built on a graphic that I'm going to pull up right now for you. No one, this is from an affidavit and simply referred to as Juror B here. No one thought she hit him on purpose or even thought she hit him on purpose. Juror B clarified that she meant to write, no one thought she hit him on purpose or even knew that she had hit him, Yannetti revealed in the new filing. I mean, I asked Peter this earlier. What does this mean for the case if, in fact, this is true, what Juror B is that Juror B is saying this and all the reporting is true? What does it do legally for the case? With the jurors basically admitting that even if she did hit him, they're saying she didn't know that she did it.
Well, I think this goes to the difference in the charging, right? Because on both counts number one, which is the second degree murder, as well as count three, which is leaving the scene of a serious bodily injury death, you have to get into the mind of the defendant, right? So you have to prove intent or you have to prove knowledge. In order to prove her guilty of manslaughter while OUI, you don't have to get into her mind. So in essence, what this jury is saying is, we thought it was an accident. We didn't think she hit him on purpose. We didn't think she intended to hit him. She may not have even known she hit him, but we, 9 out of 12 or 8 out of 12, got to the point where they did think she hit him. And the difference when dealing with an accident, so say that's the theory, right? Say that the theory is she did in fact hit him and it was in fact an accident. What the police and the district attorney's office will do is evaluate, is it truly an accident where it couldn't have been avoidable? Is this a, if it's 7 o'clock at night and it's dark and it's blizzarding and somebody comes out, steps into a crosswalk, but you didn't see them. They're going to look at what are the factors that led up to this accident, and is anybody culpable to a criminal extent, and should we charge them? In many cases, things are just determined to just be that, accidents. In this case, the problem is when you're alleged to be committing a crime while while that accident happens, which is operating under the influence of alcohol, which then causes you to drive recklessly, which then allegedly causes the death of somebody, it changes the evaluation from was this merely an unavoidable accident, or did the defendant engage in behavior which caused the recklessness, which then caused the death? So you don't have to prove that she knew. You don't have to prove that she did it on purpose. And that's why I really have said all along, the strength of the Commonwealth's case is in the manslaughter, because as the jury clearly is stating, they don't see any intent. They don't see any purposeful conduct. But that doesn't mean, I mean, I think it's interesting, the quote that you put up, in none of the affidavits that were submitted, no juror says, we don't think she hit him at all. They say, we don't think she did it on purpose. So inherent in that is the acknowledgement that they think that she did it. So,
good point.
I think the strength is the manslaughter for the Commonwealth. And that's why I think it's a distraction for them to stick to the murder charge.
Yeah, and Peter, there's more from Juror B. First, Top Cat's comment, there are no actual juror affidavits, so you can't take anything the defense says as the truth. Suppose that is true, but Juror B, according to the defense affidavit, says, and I quote here, Peter, Juror B believes that even jurors who are leaning toward a conviction on some part of indictment two will confirm that the other two indictments were acquittals. She believes that other jurors have been reluctant to come forward because there is so much public and media attention focused on the case. What do you make of this? Again, the comment from Top Cat, there are no juror affidavits. So this is all the word of the defense team speaking to the jurors. Do you trust them? Do you believe these defense attorneys?
Well, yes, but it's not. I think that there's a larger question there, not whether I believe them or we believe them, but they'd be the first to say we know that the fact that they're hearing and the prosecution has heard from people saying that they reached a verdict of not guilty on those two counts, none of that holds up legally, and that's why they're requesting, could the judge either let them actually contact these people, or can the judge somehow, interview them? And there's all kinds of ways, as I brought up, to either bring them up in a non-public hearing. There's ways to do it, or to seek out affidavits from them, and the judge can officially, legally contact them and get them to respond to her. And so that would have some weight. So I'd be the first to say, this is not nailed down at all, but we're hearing enough of this where it's certainly worth looking into, because right now it's not legally enforceable. There's no affidavits. Nobody's testified legally to this. But there are ways to nail this down and not reveal who they are, and still respect their privacy. And that could very easily be done in a number of ways.
Hmm. Linda Mon, look at this. Joel loves to instigate ridiculousness. I beg to differ. I just ask questions. Karen Reed's legal team wants to initiate contact with three other jurors. They made that clear in one of their filings. What do you make of that? I mean, they want to reach out now to other jurors. I honestly thought that they had already just done that on their own. What does this entail? I mean, legally, do they have to get permission from Beverly Cannone to go ahead and do this? And then how do you actually reach out to them?
As Peter said, everything in this case is different and unusual. You cannot reach out to a juror. They can certainly reach out to you, and then you can have a conversation. Obviously, there are lines that can't be crossed about, getting into their deliberation or inquiring of certain things. So they would need permission from the court in order to actually initiate contact with these additional jurors. I think that's unlikely to be allowed, and I think it's unlikely to be allowed because the underlying legal basis, even for argument's sake, if the judge said, okay, you can reach out to all the jurors, and all the jurors say, yes, that was in fact the case, that 12 of us were going to find her not guilty, and we were hung on the second charge, it still doesn't change the underlying legal basis for whether then, I don't know what in what world we would then say, okay, do we call them all back now that we've heard from them? And do we take a verdict? You know, it's so sort of out of the bounds of normalcy that I think because they don't really have a strong legal argument for their stance that the case should be dismissed because, in fact, this is what the jury said. I don't even think we get to the first level of inquiring of the jurors. I think that the court will probably just likely deny that outright. Not again, as Joe said, not from the bench, but we'll have, I would imagine, pretty thorough written findings rather expeditiously after the hearing.
So I pulled two tweets from two very polarizing people in this trial, and we're going to end on this because it's kind of interesting. One is from Turtle Boy from yesterday, I believe. It might be today, but I was flying, so I'm all confused about the time. And the other, and obviously Turtle Boy, is of the belief that Karen Reed is innocent, and then we've got Yellow Cottage Tales, who completely believes in Karen Reed's guilt. So the first tweet here, Peter, I don't have a graphic. I'm going to read it to you. This is tweeted out by Turtle Boy. I have confirmed that not only was Lieutenant John Fanning in charge of overseeing the jury in the Karen Reed murder trial, he was also the source who reported a juror and had her eliminated on the final day of the trial. This juror was visibly disgusted with the state police and would have voted to acquit Reed. Every Mick Albert, he calls him, a trooper who testified, sat feet away from this juror and could identify her in public. Fanning told a court officer there was a video of the juror at a bar talking about the case, but did not sign an affidavit, testify, or provide the video. Auntie Bev, the judge, just took his word for it. Despite the fact that he was a listed, this guy Fanning was a listed witness in the trial and Michael Proctor's boss. He was also under internal affairs investigation at the time. This is what corruption looks like. They literally rigged the jury. This, of course, goes with the caveat that this is all true. He is saying that he confirmed this. Peter, I see a little smirk there, and then I'll get you Yellow Cottage Tales reply to this tweet. But, I mean, what if that is the case, that he just yanked this juror? You know, this whole issue of corruption has been swirling. I wouldn't even say it's like it's you know, not in the background, it's in the forefront of this case. But what about the fact that this guy Lieutenant John Fanning was pulling someone from the jury he thought was going to acquit her?
Yeah, my smirk was more nervousness about being asked that question because you know, something out of since the day of the trial, I have done something like very close to 100 television interviews on this case. I've never dodged a question before. and I did a lot more interviews even before the trial began in the 2 years that led up to it. And I just don't know if I can really comment on that. I mean, my general answer would be if there's any criminal illegal activity done or there's any jury tampering or somebody did something untoward like that, that would blow things wide open and it would be criminal. And I just, without anything more to back that up, I really would not know how to comment on that. I don't really have any evidence or any great insight into that other than the general thing that if it ever got proven anywhere in this case that there was illegal activity in the investigation or the, or particularly in contacting the jury or tampering with the jury at all, that would be an extraordinary world of trouble. And maybe Catherine's braver than I am.
I was going to say, let me drag Catherine into this mess.
Why am I doing that? I wanted to dodge the question. Then I'm throwing it to her.
But Peter, that was a very eloquent non-answer. But Catherine, let me tell you, let's just Yellow Cottage Tales, who's complete. He's the yin to Turtle Boy's yang. He responded to Turtle Boy's tweet. And he says, I have the details on this juror. For confidentiality reasons, I have kept quiet, but she should never have been a juror, but Turtle will celebrate. She truly did go into the trial as a turtle rider and was not an honest juror. Mission accomplished. Your response to all this?
Well, I will say, and I'll tell you, Peter, because I get asked a lot about, I think that's, it's actually an important part of kind of the analysis on this case, because a lot of it is being tried on social media. And from my perspective as an attorney, I try to only comment on things that I find to be independently reliable. So what I like to discuss is, you know, what filings are in court, you know, what legal motions are being filed, what the decisions are. From my perspective, if we're taking that allegation at face value, you know, my first thought is I find it difficult. Number one, where's the information coming from? Because that decision was made at sidebar privately. So it's got to come from the defense or the Commonwealth, right? Getting to Twitter via somebody there, right? And yeah. My next question is, if this is an allegation that a trooper who's in charge of the jury says they have the video, that seems to be a big stretch to basically cross your fingers and hope that the judge doesn't say, all right, let me see the video, right? Because then if the judge says, all right, trooper, let me see the video, and he says, oh, actually, I don't have it, or there's no video, I mean, we're talking about serious consequences. So for me, I think that this is a little more, it kind of goes to the peripheral of this case, things that aren't happening in court, aren't happening, you know, between the parties, but what the information people allege to have, you know, glean and then post online for people to speculate about. I don't particularly find it reliable one way or the other. And so therefore I don't know if that I can really comment on the likelihood of it being true, but this seems to be some, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, 12 of them voted to find her not guilty on the murder. So the removal of the juror actually didn't really do much of anything. And if anything, if we're 8-4 guilty on the manslaughter, maybe we'd be 7-5 instead if it was the other way. So I'm not sure how reliable the information is, but I also don't know what the effect really would have been if the juror remained on the jury.
Mm. You know what everybody needs after a show on Karen Reed? They need to see Bacon the Pig. So let's watch together let's see what's going on here.
I have to watch her and the babies.
What's her name?
Bacon.
Bacon?
Bacon Bitch.
Oh my God, that's a beat. Wow, look at that. How old?
She's 2 days old.
My kids are going to go crazy. We live around a corner. What's her name?
Bacon Bits.
Bacon. It's so wild. Oh my God.
Yeah, she still has the placenta and everything right now.
Oh my God.
I know.
She lived in the house with you?
Right now.
Peter Ellican, would you ever get a pet pig?
I actually hear that they have a ton of personality, yeah. And they're kind of too big for people to have, but I've actually heard comments about this, that they, in some ways, they're almost like dogs. They have personalities, they have fun, they have friends, they have, they like their humans, and they get along really well. And I think they're just kind of too big and expensive to manage, and people really can't have them in the house. But other than that, I have heard that they really are, in a lot of ways, like dogs. Although there's got to be a reason why this just, you know, it's not generally accepted that people have pet pigs. It has been done.
Yeah. She's walking. She just gave birth. Poor girl, Bacon. And now her daughter, Bacon Bits. This is a firehouse, by the way, literally 50 feet from where I'm sitting. And she is a female firefighter. And she brought Bacon and Bacon Bits to work today, because when you're a firefighter, you can do whatever the hell you want. And I love it. She was taking him for a little walk in a little park across the street. I just couldn't believe my eyes. But Bacon Bits is cute. I now know what our third pet will be. I have threatened the COE. I've got three real kids and I have two dogs. So I need a third pet to even it out. And now I will go back to the firehouse and ask if we can have Bacon Bits for the house. The kids will be happy. And then finally here, yesterday, the matriarch of the show, Carm, it was her 85th birthday. My mother, we did a big TV radio show in Atlanta called the Mark Arum Show. And then we did a book signing. And this is what happened at the book signing. And then we will say goodbye. And by the way, for those who are big YouTubers, this big guy right there, that's Dr. G. Dr. G explains. He's a body, human body behavior expert. So it was an amazing. Carm loved her birthday. Every time we leave a book signing, she says the same thing. Sick of this crap. I don't want to travel anymore. It's too much for me. I'm 85 years old, but man, she loves it. She loves it. She loves the attention. Peter Elkann. Your final thoughts on, we've got this court hearing tomorrow. What's your prediction? And then we will close it out.
I've disagreed with the two other panelists where I don't think it's an absolute done deal. It's sort of ironclad that the defense is going to lose on this, but I do think it's going to be rather tough. I have heard the defense bring up they say that they have a plethora, a great deal of case law or constitutional law behind them. So it's going to be fascinating to hear their arguments. And I just think it's going to be another, it's going to be kind of another masterclass for us in lawyering. I think we're going to see really lawyering at its best tomorrow. And these are, again, as I said before, this is just, everything in this case is just so unprecedented that I mean, I can't believe that the jury came up with a verdict. They voted, they came to a verdict of not guilty, and they just didn't somehow tell anybody about it, or they didn't realize they should tell anybody about it. And they never mentioned that they were, that they had definite verdicts on two of the counts, and they were only deadlocked on one. And it's just, I would love to, I don't know, legally we can't force them to answer, but I would love to find out what went on. Did they not realize that they should mention it somehow when they sent these notes, we're deadlocked, and they didn't say we're deadlocked on one of the counts, but the other ones we've come to a decision. Did they think it was all or nothing, that if you're deadlocked on one of the counts, that means you can't give a verdict on anything? Things are kind of swirling through my head. And additionally, I would really love to know and get it nailed down whether it really was unanimous and they really did come to a verdict. Because right now we're only hearing the reports that the lawyers and the prosecution are hearing from just a few people. And as somebody said, there's no affidavits. There's nothing legally binding there. So as usual, I'm on this case, I'm fascinated, and I have a million questions, and I'm hoping some of them might get answered tomorrow, but there's no way to really enforce that, and the judge doesn't have to.
There you go. This is no truer words ever spoken. Justice for John O'Keefe here. Don't know if that's ever coming, sadly. Martin Smallwood in Ireland wishing Carm a happy birthday. Catherine Loftus, your final thoughts before we head out.
I think, as Peter said, you're going to see it's always fun as another lawyer to see really experienced trial attorneys argue a case. So I'm sure watching Marty Weinberg will be enjoyable, to say the least. Nonetheless, I think she's likely, again, anything is within the realm of possibility. I think based on the legal standard, the judge is likely to deny the motion to dismiss. I think it's going to be appealed. I think the appeals court will affirm the denial of the motion to dismiss and will likely be on track for a January trial.
Truth be told, I'm not sure what this is referencing. Can't go back or won't. Judge's discretion. Rent should go to person whose life. I'm not sure what this is, but it is a super chat nonetheless. Peter Elkann. Marty Weinberg's got nothing on you, man.
He really does. You know, I hate it. It almost sounds like I'm buttering him up, and I'm talking in superlatives. He's brilliant. He's revered. He has gravitas, but it really is true. He is a major heavyweight in the field and very, very well respected. And on the intellectual side of the law, if anybody can come up with constitutional reasons and case law that, you know, the average lawyer hasn't even heard of, he will absolutely bring that up. So I do speak to him in revered tones.
Peter, final question. You're on vacation. When you're on vacation, do you do work? Because I was just telling Carm, I can never relax, and I'm going to LA for a week. And usually the thing that makes me most tense is too relaxed to do nothing. So I'll probably be doing crap all week that I shouldn't be doing. But I just want to know, do you work when you're on vacation?
Yeah, I've kept it to a minimum this time, but little things come in when you have I envy people who work for either a giant, a big law firm or a big corporation, because then they just say, I'm going for the week. You're going to cover for me and there's this take care of it and I'll get back to it. But the nature of criminal defense work, I mean, things are happening like every day and clients are very scared and they're stressful. And there's just so many moving parts every day when you have a number of cases and things come up. And questions come up, and then, even some clients who are aware that I'm on vacation say, I hate to bother you, but something urgent came up. And it really is difficult to ever get away 100%. And in the old days, it was hard to get, if your lawyer went on vacation, you just, he was out of contact. But nowadays, everybody knows, we have email, we have cell phones. You just can't say, well, the phone rang in my office and I'll get back and return my calls when I return. It's just the exact same thing. I'm getting on a rant here, but the exact same thing happens. It used to be that if you called your lawyer after 6 o'clock at night, the lawyer would maybe, if it was good, would return the calls the next day when he comes in. But now the clients won't settle for that. They just, again, they know that there's email and texting and cell phones, and don't tell me that, I can't get a hold of you because you're not in the office, physically in the office where your phone is, where you'd be getting the messages and nobody's here. And then I'm even talking about even before we had answering machines on phones. See, if you called an office, what would happen? You just simply, it would ring and ring and you say, well, I'll call when somebody's in the next day. So we can never get away with it from it. And that's why clients are calling evenings, weekends. It's a, it's a miserable life, and I wouldn't wish lawyering on anybody.
Great, great ending there, but I got to give Catherine the last word. I have to explain to my kids what an answering machine is. I taught them what a map was the other day. I explained what a map was. Also explained that I did not have Google in college. They just did not understand any of this. Why is a kid ever going to have to work again with AI? They can just say, hey, write me a paper. It's not plagiarism. That's going to change everything. Catherine Loftus, when you go on vacation, number one, do you go to some sort of Zen spa? And number two, do you do work or do you relax, Catherine Loftus?
I do mostly relaxing with a little bit of work. I go to, actually just got back from 2 weeks on the lake in Maine. No TV, little cottage, nothing, to really distract me. But I think the benefit, I'm sure everybody, you guys know, there's lots of pros to being self-employed or employed with your dad, but the cons are that there's no one else to really jump in as much, So sometimes you do have to answer those emails, but I think it's all about balance, right? So you go away, you do like 20%, you tell everybody, you deal with the emergencies, everything else you say, you can wait until I come back.
Very well put. On that note, love you, America. Love you. Boston, Mass. Love you, Canton, Mass. Justice for John O'Keefe. We're off next week, but there will be programming every single day. Surviving My Biggest Case. No Phil and Scott tomorrow. Maybe next Friday. Follow me on Twitter, podcast STS, Instagram, Surviving Survivor, and I'll post show times, show dates, all that. Wish me luck. I'm taking 3 kids on a plane tomorrow. I don't know what's tougher, that or bringing Carm on a plane. No rest for the weary. I'm up at 5 a.m., headed back to MIA. See ya in a week, everybody. Take care.